Let's maybe get started. So today I have the great pleasure of introducing Danielle Singier from optimization in a company called Hatch. And she's going to be giving us a seminar on representing production with a special representation, UOPSS, which means, I guess, unit operation, production, state scheduling. And it's going to be, as you can see, kind of a very interesting alternative representation to state task network and resource task network. But let me say just a few words about Danielle. So she obtained her undergraduate degree at the Federal University of Rio. Actually, Christiana Lara, who's here in the audience, is also graduate of that program. And I have to say that actually I had the great pleasure of meeting Danielle when I was in an evaluation trip from CAPES, of the organization in Brazil for assessing programs, and that's was quite impressed when she was an undergrad student and was very articulate in, you know, describing the program there. She then went to McMaster University, where she obtained her PhD degree with Tom Marlin. And after that, she actually worked at Honeywell Solutions, where she worked with Jeff Kelly. It was during that time where, you know, she developed with him the scheduling representation that we're going to see. She then went back to Brazil, where she was with copies of the graduate program at the Federal University of Rio, and she, you know, started one of the first industrial consortia in Brazil, at least in this area. And then, you know, came back to Canada, where she's working with Hatch, and is also an adjunct professor at McMaster University in the computing software department. At Hatch, very briefly, she's a optimization specialist, and she works in planning and scheduling, and especially some of the applications she's worked on have to deal with both long-term and short-term, and also actually a real-time operation of power generation systems, and also systems related, for example, to the food industry. Okay? And of course, she's also done quite a bit of work in the area of crude oil scheduling. So today, again, we have the great pleasure of having Danielle describing to us the UOPSS representation. Okay, so Danielle, welcome, and we look forward to your talk.
Thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you for inviting me as well to this seminar series. So today, as Professor Grossman mentioned, I'll be presenting an alternative representation of production, which over the years I've found really handy. So hopefully you'll find it interesting as well, and maybe you'll, you know, give it a try and see if, you know, how you'll get a better feel for it as well. So let me just start off by just very quickly introducing Hatch. Hatch is an engineering company that addresses mostly mining, energy, and infrastructure projects, but there are comprehensive services, including optimization, that cover basically all of the sectors and beyond those main sectors as well. So mining, energy, and infrastructure have been historically the biggest areas for Hatch, but we're starting to get into other domains as well now. It's quite a large company, so it's about 9,000 people worldwide. Head office is in Mississauga, so it's close to where my office is, which is Niagara Falls, and there are other offices spread around the world. Now, before I start talking about UOPS in general, I'll just very quickly tell you some of the interesting optimization applications I've been involved with at Hatch, but I don't want to dwell too long on those, but I'd be happy to talk a bit more about any one of those in case you're interested after the talk. So my department, it lies within renewable power, which is within the energy part of Hatch. Within renewable power, there are several software products available. One of the longest standing one, and it's still ongoing, is Vista DSS. Nothing to do with the Microsoft Vista. It actually, I think, was before Microsoft Vista. But it's Vista Decision Support System. It's an advanced planning and scheduling tool for hydroelectric power generation systems. So it's a really neat piece of software. I think the key thing is that it does planning, long-term planning, so several years planning, It does the short-term scheduling, so hourly scheduling over a few weeks, and real-time dispatch of operations, so five-minute increments over a few hours. And all of it is integrated. So that's, I think, the very neat thing about it, which was what I found super interesting when I joined Hatch about 4 years ago, is that you enter the model once, and then you have the long-term planning module, which basically massages the data in a way that makes it amenable for a long-term planning model, but it's done automatically for you. And then the short-term scheduling model, same thing. So you're, the model that you entered is also, say, processed in a certain way to make it amenable for scheduling, application, and the same thing for the dispatch. And the three modules, they do talk to each other. So the very important aspect of integration between planning and scheduling and dispatch is taken care of. And there's a really neat module that replicates operations. So you do the long-term planning and the short-term scheduling automatically. So all of that integration between the long-term plan and the short-term schedule is done automatically for you. And there's a whole bunch of ways to do it. And so it's really neat. And it's been around for quite a few years. And it's really the best in class. And we've recently extended it to do hydrothermal generation planning and scheduling as well, taking into account all of the ancillary services and things like that, and energy market and all of that. HydroVantage is a completely different tool, mainly geared towards hydroelectric operations as well, but it's meant to do the long-term risk-based asset management of hydro facilities. So you have a probability of failure curve and the cost curve of intervening on pieces of equipment, and you combine the two, you get the optimal point of intervention for the piece of equipment, and we can do that for several pieces of equipment simultaneously for, like, over the horizon, a very long-term horizon, so 20, 30, 40 years. Look ahead to do the capital expenditure long-term planning, and it's, again, risk-based because we do have the probability of failure curves for those hydro components. But the methodology could be extended to other process industries as long as the reliability data is available. The methodology is pretty generic as well. The GIS screening tool for hydroelectric generation potential was a very recent development. And what was done there was, if you have very large geographic areas and you really are trying to plan what would be the optimal locations of hydroelectric facilities, so generation facilities. So what was done there was to combine the GIS map data and to automatically determine what would be the optimal potential locations along the river system where a dam could be built. And for each option, there was a model created to estimate the economic benefits and the capital incentives or the capital cost of building each one of those dams and facilities. And it resulted in thousands of options. And then with the optimization, we basically picked the best option, and this one won the 2014 Canadian Consulting Engineers Award. We applied this to large sections of Alberta and Northern Ontario as well here in Canada. It could be applied elsewhere as well. The wind collector tool is an optimization tool that once it's for wind turbine locations. So there's a lot of work done to determine potential locations of wind turbines according to the wind patterns and so forth, and noise constraints, so you can't be too close to houses and things like that. So you determine where your turbines are going to be. But on top of that, there's another optimization problem, which is how to optimally connect these turbines to minimize the cost of cabling, essentially. But there are constraints involved in that, and it's quite an interesting optimization problem as well. We've done, there are two alternative optimization formulations for this one. One has been published. The other one, we haven't published it yet. But it's a quite a neat little optimization problem, I think. Other than that, we also recently developed an optimal capital expenditure levelizing tool. So you have many different capital expenditures, and you might have constraints, precedence constraints, for instance. So one expenditure can only occur before another one, or you have expenditure thresholds. You have a whole series of constraints you might want to apply to capital expenditures. So we developed a tool for doing that, and that's actually combined even with the asset management tool as a post-processing. So we developed a risk-based asset management plan, and then we can also levelize it as well, but we can do levelizing on non-risk-based decisions as well if needed. And very recently, we developed a train optimizer. So this is called the Hatch Rail Optimizer, and I'll touch briefly on that in the last few slides because it is based on UOPS, so it was interesting to include it in this presentation as well. So any comments, questions so far? Please feel free to interrupt or ask any questions or comments throughout the talk. Without further ado, then, let's get to the real topic of the presentation, which is representing production systems. So why do that? As you all know, production systems can get quite complicated. So they're highly complex systems. And with increasing computational power, we manage to solve more and more complicated systems. So we have the computing power to solve things that were not solvable just a few decades ago. The representations help structure the problem equations. So you can visualize operation rules or constraints or connectivity. Each element in a representation has a known set of equations, so it makes it an object-oriented way of building scheduling models. And when you do that, if you improve the formulations for each one of those elements in the representation, you're tightening really the formulation as a whole across multiple models. So if you have an object that, for instance, is a certain type of task, and you come up with a better set of equations that represent that task, well, all of the models that use that particular task will be potentially improved as well. So it's very efficient. And very importantly as well, when using a representation, the models become faster to build as opposed to having to code the equations from scratch, just coming up with every independent equations without having a view of the overall model. And they're also simpler to maintain. And maintenance is really key to sustainable decision support models. So if people cannot maintain your model, it will get turned off very quickly. So it has to be very easy to maintain as well. In addition to being cheap and easy to build, it has to be easy to maintain. So the representations do help in achieving that goal. So let's start with an example I've used before, and I think it's very clear in terms of what we're trying to convey, which is the produce processing plant. So suppose there's spring water and three different types of concentrates in a fruit juice plant. There's a single blend header. Three types of end products are produced with different specifications. You can produce pure grape juice blend, and grape blend. And those are actual commercial names, but they mean completely different things. So pure grape juice is just grape and water. Grape juice blend is grape pear concentrate and water for basically to get the sweetness and things like that. And grape blend is grape pear and apple concentrate plus water. Okay. The end products are then, after the blender, sent to dedicated storage tanks. Just for this example, they could be other types of tanks. Let's just stick with dedicated storage tanks. And after that, they're sent to either bottle or carton packaging lines, according to the client demands. Okay? So how can we better understand this process? Okay, how can we represent it? Okay, so you have the concentrates here on the left-hand side that go to the blender, and those go to dedicated product tanks, so each one for each type of juice. And then a carton line and a bottle line, and they satisfy some shipping demands. But what information from what was stated in the previous slide is missing from this one? It's almost complete, but not quite. There's something missing here. And what's missing is the fact that you have modes of operation or tasks in this process. So the blender can be in three different modes of operation. So it can be in juice one, juice two, or juice three task. Depending on which mode of operation it's in, its inputs will be different. So in this juice one, you'll have only two inputs, so grape and water, three inputs and four inputs in terms of the material that's going into it. Same thing for the packaging lines here. So they're also packaging different types of juices, but only the physical piece of equipment is shown here. So what were the alternatives that were created to represent the production? So, of course, as you're probably all aware, according to the batch production standards like S88, SP95, focus on the product recipes. So what needs to be done to the concentrates or to the juice, the materials, and the tasks to be performed on them. So the first representation that was proposed was a state test network in 93. And again, it had a very strong focus on batch processes. So there is a state, so what flows through the system, which usually refers to raw materials, intermediate, and final products, and graphically represented by circles, and the tasks that are actions performed in those states, graphically represented by rectangles. So if we were to represent the fruit juice example as an STN, it would look something like this. So you get the states, your individual concentrates, apple, pear, grape, water, and then they go through tasks. So blend juice one, blend juice two, and blend juice three. This produces the different juice types. And then they go through other tasks of juice one goes through package carton task, and then it becomes a state of cartons, juice one, or juice two in cartons and things like that, and in bottles down here. So this is roughly what the STN would look like, which is fair enough. Now you know what's happening to your material throughout the process, and you have a very clear understanding of what the production steps are or the recipes are for this particular product. It's very simple representation that whenever you can apply it, shows good results. It's usually applied to batch processes through a batch production recipe. There are typically no explicit references to storage limitations even of the states themselves in the classical form of STN. Does not incorporate references to any physical piece of equipment. So you don't know of blenders. You don't know of tanks. You know about the states and the tasks that are performed on them. And typically, you assume unlimited connectivity in the system, so everything is connected to everything. Now, to address the issue of no idea about blenders and tanks or any sort of physical piece of equipment, STN was extended to incorporate those limitations because those are pretty important limitations. It makes a huge difference if you have three blenders, three dedicated blenders for the three juices, or a single blender that has to blend the three types of juices. So RTN addressed that issue by incorporating those renewable resources in the form of equipment, labor, utilities, these types of things, in addition to the non-renewable resources, which are the raw materials, intermediate, and final products. And the resources, the renewable resources, can be consumed and or generated by tasks. So the blender is consumed by the blending task and then freed up after the blending task is done. And tasks, once again, is the actions performed on these resources. So if we were to go back to the fruit juice example and just grab a little bit of this flow sheet here, this is roughly what it would look like in RTN. So now you have the A, the task of storing A, which consumes the apple tank and frees it up when it's done. And then the A prime would be the stored A state, and then that goes through the blender, which consumes the blending task, which consumes the blender equipment, and so forth. Okay? I didn't do the rest because it would be quite large. And that's a little bit of one of the points I would like to make as well. So RTN is more detailed than STN, including renewable resources, but it's still very batch-oriented through this batch production recipe. and the graphical representation can become quite complicated depending on, you know, like even for the simple blending example, this would become a bit of a complicated view of the process. So even batch production processes are equipment-centric when you get down to operations. So operators want to know where the batches are going to be produced, which piece of equipment is going to be producing that particular batch. So there is still an equipment-centric view even for batch production processes. So the third idea was, instead of starting off with the product recipe or production recipe, would be to start off from the physical layout, so get your process flow diagram, and extend it to include the modes of operation and connectivity of your system. So instead of starting with the tasks and attaching the physical pieces of equipment to the tasks, go the other way around. Start with the physical pieces of equipment and attach the tasks to them, in a sense. So that's where the unit operation port state superstructure started. And it started with Jeff Kelly in 2005. So this was his original publication on it. So the representation is very similar to a process flow diagram, but with information on operation modes and tasks. So this is why it received the name. So you have unit, which is the physical unit. You have operations, which are the modes of operations within a physical unit. Think of those as tasks as well. States, which are the same thing as STN, for instance, it's the same types of states. It can be renewable or non-renewable states as well, just like the RTN. And ports are those little entry and exit points of a piece of equipment. So the port, an inlet port, is like an uncontrolled blender, and an outlet port is an uncontrolled splitter of this piece of equipment. If you want to control how much comes in and out, you can always put in multiple inlet and or outlet ports as well. But if you don't, you're just uncontrolled blenders and uncontrolled splitters here. So those are the ports. So that's where the name came from. So this is what the fruit juice process would look like in UOPS terms. So this was the original process flow diagram. Now the blender has three modes of operation while you see them here. So these are the three modes of operation, and the dotted line shows you the where the physical piece of equipment is. Therefore, you have a single use constraint that says only one of those can be active at a time in scheduling terms. And you have one binary for each mode of operation. And the interesting thing is that now you can have very different connectivity for each mode of operation you're in, and it's trivial to configure that because you're configuring each mode of operation individually like this. So the Apple tank is really only connected to the blender whenever it's in this mode of operation, but you see it's not connected in any one of those two modes of operation. Pear, it's only on those two modes of operation, and grape is the three of them. So now they go to dedicated product tanks, but they could have been multi-purpose tanks as well. It's just that this example, we just put them as dedicated tanks, but that's fine. Packaging lines, same thing. So three modes of operation here, and we know what the physical piece of equipment is here with the dotted lines. Okay, so it looks pretty similar still to the process flow diagram, but with the extension of the modes of operation. So it is an equipment-centric representation, and it's completely agnostic to the type of process. You can apply UOPS to discrete parts manufacturing processes, batch processes, continuous processes, or a combination thereof. You can seamlessly combine renewable and non-renewable resources, both as physical pieces of equipment, but also as different types of states, and I'll show this to you in a second. You can easily represent final and intermediate products. It doesn't really matter if you're taking the output as this flow or that flow, or if you decide to further process this downstream, it really doesn't matter in terms of the UOPS representation. Now, the limitation that I see with you also is that in some instances, it's a more difficult visualization of the production recipes. Not that you can't deal with the recipes. You can certainly code them up. I mean, it is considered in here. All the same recipes that you saw in the STN and RTN slides are in this configuration. It's just that if you wanted to have a clear indication of what happens to a certain component throughout your process, you might lose that aspect of the visualization. But you can certainly incorporate it in the model, and the model solution will incorporate that as well. The incorporation of the renewable resources, of course, the explicit configuration of the equipment does that because it is a renewable resource, but you can also do it through states, and this is an interesting point, I think. You can have a tank or a pool or an inventory of packaging operators, so you can only operate these packaging lines if you have enough operators to do so, okay? So they're not juice, but they're operators, and you can specify that this packaging line can only ever operate if it receives the juice and if it receives an operator from this group of operators. Once this process is done, then same thing as the RTN, is it frees up this operator to go back into the pool. You may want to do that, or this may not be necessary, but if you do need to incorporate different types of states into the same model, meaning actual products and people, like personnel or even pieces of equipment that may be used by multiple processes, you can do that very easily here. So you can incorporate, in this case, shift or personnel availability constraints, because now you're modeling them explicitly, so then it becomes a trivial task. You can have different personnel requirements per process, so maybe the packaging lines require two people, but the bottling lines only require one. That's fine. Just put it as an inverse yield here coming into the bottle line, drawing from either the same pool of people or a different pool of people. So it gets very easy to incorporate different types of states in your process and different types of constraints as well. So do you have any questions so far? Okay, let me keep on going. So the main idea behind not only UOF, but STN and RTN as well, as you know, is to move away from the coding of matrices to coding of equations in GAMS, AMPL, and MOSEL to really coding through a flow sheet. So really you get an object type and you drag it to a flow sheet that already contains a set of predefined equations which behave in a certain way that you want your production to reflect. And that's important because production has three main characteristics. So there's the logic aspect of production, on and off, different modes of operation, quantities, and qualities. And there's this quantity, logic, quality paradigm that's very important as well to UOPs. We have published papers documenting equations that we have typically used for both quantity and logic, and also later I'll show you the reference for quantity and quality. So the quantity and logic aspect of production is what we call the logistic model. And you can have more references. I'm not going to put in a whole bunch of equations in this presentation, but they do exist. They're in this reference here. Several of those equations are in this publication. So what is it based on? What are those logistic equations based on? They're based on this fill, hold, draw behavior of processing units. So we believe that every single element in production behaves according to a certain fill, hold, draw pattern. So when you start off with a piece of equipment, there's a moment in time in which it's filling, so the inventory goes up, and then you wait with the material in it, and then it draws. Okay? Depending on which element you're trying to represent, it will have a unique type of fill, hold, draw behavior. The types of elements that we believe can represent 99.9% of production, and I'm still trying to find out what the 0.1% is, are process units, which may be either batch or continuous process units. For continuous process units, in a sense, are really a subset of batch with zero hold time. So batch production units, you fill them up, you wait, you draw. With continuous process units, you fill and draw at the same time, so the hold is zero. Full units, or inventory units, pipeline units, which are first in, first out, file line units, which are first in, last out, like when you have restriction, when you're dealing with solids handling, and you build the piles of material, but then when reclaiming, you have to reclaim the last one that you filled. So that's the pile line unit and parcel unit, which represents the industrial shipping pattern of fill in one port. And then you unload successively a few times, but then you have to wait for it to return to the original port to load again. But you can really think of these production objects based on their behavior. So really batch units are nothing more than a delay behavior, which can be a batch process unit, but it can also be a transportation unit. So if you load your truck with material, you have to wait a while, and then the material gets unloaded elsewhere. Well, that's a batch behavior. So you can use the same type of object to represent multiple things. An inventory behavior obviously can be a tank. It can be a warehouse. As shown, can also be a pool of resources that you have available. So it's really inventory. And again, the same equations that apply to one type of to tanks will apply to warehouses as well if you're trying to replicate the inventory behavior. Same thing, anything that has a first-in, first-out behavior is in a queue. And with memory of what's in that queue, if you will, has a predefined set of equations, last in, first out, and successive draw and lag behavior. So by combining these objects, it becomes a very powerful representation because you can build a model for pretty much anything you can dream of. And so far, I've applied this to many different industries. I haven't encountered yet an example that I haven't been able to think of in terms of those objects, in particular those two first ones. Like, those two first ones are incredibly powerful, a combination of them. And how do these objects relate to equations? I will not go much into equations right now because it's really not the point. But there are binary variables that are used to describe this fill-hold-draw behavior. And I'm giving you an example of discrete time, but it does not mean at all that UOPS is only applicable to discrete time. The equations that are in the paper that I just talked about are in discrete time because that's the type of representation that we've had most success using in industry just because it can incorporate exogenous information just like maintenance in the future. It's a very tight formulation as well, so we've had a lot of success with the discrete time, but UOPS could very easily be used for continuous time representation as well. It would just be a matter of creating the equations for, or using the equations for inventories and batch units and pipelines for continuous time within the UOPS framework. So in the discrete time example, we have these four types of variables that I'm sure you're well acquainted with, which are the startup variables, are only one when the piece of equipment or the element starts up. Setup, which is one while the element is in operation. This one I'll skip because it's a little mathematical trick. And the shutdown, which is one when the element shuts down. The switch over to itself is a little binary variable that means that it's switching over to the same operation, but the reason why it exists, I'll show you in the following slide. So there's that fill, hold, draw inventory profile. So this is how these variables, how they behave for a fixed size variable time batch unit. So you have the startup when the equipment is starting up, and then it's up for a certain amount of time. The switch over to itself is the same as the setup except for the first time period when the startup is one, and then you have the shutdown equal to one when the equipment shuts down. Now, here's a little trick. By having this extra variable here, this means that of the four binary variables, four sets of binary variables, only one of them needs to be defined as explicitly binary. The other three can be relaxed to continuous between 0 and 1, and the integrality will be implied by this set of equations. So this is why the little switch over to itself exists, so that we can enforce the integrality on the other variables. So if you're dealing with a fixed size variable time batch unit, only the setup needs to be binary. The others are dependent binary variables, so continuous variables essentially. And if it's a fixed time batch unit, only the startup needs to be binary. The other ones will be binary just because of these equations. So it's implied. So this formulation is also in the other paper. And it also has an efficient sequence-dependent set of equations as well, which I will not get into, but if anybody is interested in taking a look at the formulation for the sequence-dependent formulation, it's also in this reference. So with the quantity and quality model, so we've addressed the quantity and logic, so flows, inventory amounts, and the binary variables, but we also have the quantity and quality aspect of it. So continuous units, well, they can be quite different. They have different purposes, if you will. So when you need to address quality issues as well, there are different types of processes that can be considered. Again, they do have predefined sets of equations that are outlined in this recent paper here. So we have blending processes, splitting processes, which are the opposite of blending, separation, when you have components in your stream, so you want to separate out components, so it's not the same as splitting. So splitting is splitting flows, separating is separating components. Fractionation, just like in oil refineries, you have the fractionator unit, which are really a combination of splitting and separator units. And you have reactors, in which you can use the stoichiometry to determine what the yields of the products will be. So with those types of processes, you can take care of a lot in your models. As for the solution approach, again, as most of us know, of course, we end up with a mixed integer nonlinear programming problem. When the problems become too large to manage, unfortunately, we can't just throw this yet at a solver and just mathematically come up with a solution. So for now, we still, most problems we have to decompose. So the approach would be that we've taken in the past quite successfully has been to solve the mixed integer problem of quantity and logic, where we proxy the quality aspects through, for instance, yields and recipes and the units, and make it be in the ballpark of where we think it's reasonable, such that when you go to the quantity and quality problem, it's already in the ballpark. So you have the modes of operations and your binary variables in the ballpark of where they should be, hopefully. And then you fix the binary variables, solve the quantity quality with a nonlinear solver, and then back to the quantity and logic problem once again, and you iterate until you converge. So in terms of the industrial examples, we've applied this to many, many different types of processes, and I'll just talk about two or three. This was a sequence-dependent oil refining process, and it was very interesting because we were contacted and asked if we did oil refining, and we said, yes, of course, we do oil refining, and it ended up being an edible oil refining process. That threw us off a little bit, but yes, we could do that too. So we ended up, and it was a very interesting sequence-dependent problem because depending on the type of oil being processed, they had 53 different types of oils that could potentially be produced, but those fell within 8 groups, oil groups, depending on which group was processed in this deodorizer that takes the odor out of the oils to produce margarine. Depending on the sequence of those groups, then an empty tray had to be inserted in the deodorizer because you don't want your margarine tasting like fish oil. So the sequence-dependent problem was important so that they reduced the amount of overtime that they had on the weekend, which resulted from whenever they didn't do it quite right, they went into the weekend. So that's how they buffered their infeasibilities in terms of sequencing. And when we went there, they were doing it actually by hand, and it took the poor guy like 3 hours to figure out the whole schedule, and super experienced guy. And it took him hours to figure it out. And whenever he was on vacation, we asked him, like, what happens when you're on vacation? And he said, okay, productivity goes down by 20%, but, you know, it just means overtime on the weekend. But we managed to solve this problem. It was quite interesting. It was very similar to the prize collecting traveling salesman problem. So quite interesting. Now, UOPS allows for easy model expansion. So in the same deodorizer problem, if we wanted to expand it to incorporate other aspects of production, like the tanks of oils that fed the deodorizer and maybe a blender or some processing unit that fed those tanks, that you could do it successively. So you don't need to build the entire model at once. You could just build this part, because all that connects the rest to this are really these connectivity equations that say that the output of this guy is equal to the input of this guy, and that's it. So you could successively build your model, which is very important when you're building models like this, which was another model that we built for an entire refinery. So here you have the settling tanks, the distillation units, all the way to the blenders over here, and it solves quite efficiently. Now, and we applied this as well to metals casting, which is a batch, really, process. So it's all in here in terms of the different types of products being produced by different paths within the system. So the connectivity does take care of that, because what you don't see here is really the modes of operation that are in each one of those pieces of equipment. It is being taken care of by this connectivity. But again, it gets a little bit difficult to see the recipes for each one of those different types of products. But this is a batch process combined with a continuous casting process combined with the ladles, which are discrete. So it's a combination of different types of units in a process. And very recently, we came across this infrastructure problem. And this is the last one that I'll show for now, because I know we're kind of running out of time. So there's a little trains here. You'll have to bear with me, because those are trains going in opposite directions on a single track. Those are passing loops. So this is where trains are allowed to pass each other. So when you have a single train track and you have trains coming in opposite directions, this guy has to go to station B, and then train 2 has to go into the passing loop so that train 1 can continue on its journey. And then another train comes in. So you see how this thing can get convoluted quite quickly in terms of scheduling, because there are single line segments like the one I showed, where only one train can go in any direction at any point in time, and double line segments as well. So some sections of your rail corridor can be single track, others double track, and you have to deal with both of them. There are tens of stations, so I just showed you 3 stations, but there's tens of stations and passing loops, many trains per day in both directions, different trains. It gets better because there are different train sizes and different priorities. And because the train sizes have to match the passing loop, so not all passing loops can accommodate all train sizes. So if you have a very long train, it's not going to fit into a short passing loop because the tail end of the train is going to just stay on the main line. So you cannot use short passing loops for long trains. So you have to take into account that not all of the passing loops can be used by all of the trains. So you have to match one to the other. Plus, it's an incredibly stiff system in terms of the time, because the train run times are in the order of minutes. So they get from station to station in the order of minutes. But we were asked for a week-long schedule for the train. So we did configure this using UOPS, and we obtained the train schedule for the whole week. I'm just showing you the first 2 days, which is complicated enough, I think. So this is space, and this is time. So here it's the first station, second station, third station, and so forth until the 20th or so. And this means that this train is traversing this section here during this time, and then it moves on to the next section and next section and next section. So you see the trains going down and trains coming up. The highlighted red here are double line segments, so there are trains, they can overlap here at the same moment in time, so they're going in opposite directions here, but in any other section, they cannot be there at the same moment in time. And you see each color is a different train size, so they have a different type of passing loop usage as well. So when we configured this up for an entire week, we ended up with a pretty large optimization problem. So with a two-day horizon, we ended up with 38,000 binaries. With the seven-day horizon, we ended up with, and this is the pre-solved value, so this is the original values and pre-solved values in parentheses. So we ended up with 235,000 binaries and over a million non-zeros. This is already pre-solved. But because of the way the problem is structured, these are the runtimes that we got for this particular example. So in 20 minutes, it managed to find the solution for the seven-day horizon with 10-minute time periods. And we got provably optimal solutions within the CPLEX heuristic prior to even entering the branch and bound tree. So that was, you know, pretty, I think, interesting results. This model can be used not only for finding feasible schedules, which is already very tricky for this system. The current tools that are in the market for train scheduling are simulation-based tools or rule-based tools. They're not doing this level of optimization at all. And what happened with those tools is that this particular system that we were applying it to was so convoluted in terms of single and double lines and passing loop sizes and different train sizes and priorities that the tools basically after 12 hours of processing just gave up, ran out of memory or something. So the best-in-class commercial software tools could not solve this problem for even 2 days horizon. And so even finding a this is just a feasible solution. I'm not even talking about the optimal, you know, fastest train traversing problem. This is just finding the feasible solution for the trains in this system, so finding feasible solutions and optimal schedules as well. We do have a handle on priorities of trains, so you can assign different train priorities through optimization. We can assign, of course, fixed schedules because you can force the train to just go through the system without stopping. It's very useful for quick recovery from unforeseen events. So, for instance, if a locomotive breaks down in the middle of the system, this is a really big problem for simulation-based tools because their rules and heuristics are based on launches from the extreme of the system. So if anything breaks halfway, it's a problem. So with optimization, of course, you can recover quickly from that. You can do maintenance planning of the tracks. We can use it for engineering studies as well for determining the rail system's maximum capacity, so maximizing the number of trains through. Optimal location of passing loops, for instance. So you can do the trade-offs between the capital expenditures on passing loops versus how much you will gain from passing extra trains through the system, so you can locate the passing loops optimally. And this has been found so useful by Hatch that we have just filed for provisional patents on the Hatch Rail Optimizer as well. But I will leave further details on the UOPS formulation for hopefully for CAPCO, because this is a paper that we've just submitted. So it's exactly the details on the UOPS representation of this problem for optimal rail scheduling in limited flexibility environments, so single tracks and double tracks. So just concluding, UOPS is a good alternative to RTN for developing production models. So it's something that I think it's a representation that shouldn't be dismissed. I think it should be looked at least investigated, because it is incredibly powerful. By the way, the rail model, we put it together from scratch in 2 weeks. So because of UOS, because once we managed to think about the model in UOS terms and think about which elements of UOS we would need to build that rail system, coding the equations was the easy part. So we knew exactly which equations to code. So it took just a few weeks from scratch, like just from nothing. It allows for quick and flexible model development. You have an easy visualization of the model structure, and it already has a pretty tight model formulation for the discrete time models. Of course, for the continuous time, it's still to be investigated, so the continuous time equations should be added to the UOPS framework as well in the future. But with all formulations, it can always be improved, so I look forward to, you know, further research on UOPS so that the base formulations can also be improved and tightened so that everybody's models become faster and more efficient. So with that, I'd also like to acknowledge Jeff Kelly, who's been incredibly generous with all of his knowledge for starting off with UOPS. So he was the one who thought of it in 2005. I came on board in 2006 and 2007, and we further developed it, but he was incredibly generous with everything, like his knowledge and letting me contribute to it as well. And I'd like to thank you all for your attention, for Professor Grossman for inviting me, and Breno Meneses as well for suggesting my name. So with that, okay. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Right. Thank you very much. So I guess we usually have a shy audience out there, but is anybody out there who would like to ask a question to Danielle? What about here in the room? Any questions? Yeah, I guess.
Very nice presentation. My first question would be, what is the minimal set of constraints that are required for any kind of application? What was the absolutely mandatory constraints that are required to use this framework?
There is really no minimum because it depends on what you want to do with your system. So what is the minimum system in general? So you could, let's go back to the fruit juice one. So you could potentially just have a model with an inventory unit. I don't know. So you could have just the inventory equation. So there's no minimum requirement. So I think a better answer to your question is the following. Maybe your question is, so inventory units, how many constraints do inventory units imply? Is that it, maybe? Inventory units, for instance, can be as simple as just the plain, you know, inventory is equal to the inventory of previous time period plus in minus out. But you can have, there are already predefined equations that you can pull in to the model that make it more complex whenever you need it to. So, for instance, in inventory units, there is a startup when below equations. Well, what that means is that you can only start up a different mode of operation in a tank when it's below a certain inventory level. So that's already predefined in that reference. So that takes care of the heel issue in tanks. So if you don't have an issue of heels in tanks, so if you don't have to draw a tank to such a low value so that you can put in a different grade of gasoline, for instance, in, if you don't have that problem, don't put it in because it's going to make your problem more complex. But if you do have that concern, and if that's a true concern of your production, you should put it in. But the nice thing is that this type of equation has already been predefined for you. So if you do need it, it's already there for you. It's just a matter of grabbing it and just coding it in. So you don't have to think about, oh, how should I, you know, code up an equation that will only allow my inventory unit to switch from regular to premium gasoline when it's below a certain level. You don't have to think about it because an efficient formulation already exists for that. You see, so that's the advantage. So it's as simple as you'd like it to be, down to a single equation, but it can be very complex if your system is very complex. But what we always say to, you know, when consulting on this, is that you should really make your model as simple as possible, but no simpler, just like Einstein, right? So it's always as simple as possible, but no simpler. But we should always strive to make it as simple as possible, but enough to represent the true complexities of the system. But don't add extra complexity if you don't need to. So that reduces the number of equations and the complexity to, you know, to solve the overall model. But there is no predefined number of equations. It really depends on how many elements, the types of elements, what you want to do with each one of the elements. So it's very flexible that way.
Okay. Let's see, Daniel, since we're running out of time, let me just ask you one last quick question. If you are given a problem where it's batch, it's discrete time, and you could use either, say, RTN or the UOPSS, have you made any comparisons in terms of size of the problem and tightness of the linear programming? In other words, which MILP would be easier to solve?
No, we haven't made that comparison, and I would love to be involved in such a comparison because I think it's time that we made such a comparison. Our experience has been basically just the practical implementation of UOPS and the huge success rate, really, with UOPS that's never let us down, if you will, in practical applications. But we haven't gone back to trying to, and really it's not for lack of interest, it's really like we would like to get people that are really specialized in RTN to do the RTN part of this job, and it would be great to do that because we could code up an RTN and maybe not the most efficient RTN. We know how to do UOPS for sure, but the RTN perhaps it wouldn't be the best, you know, comparison RTN-wise, but we would be thrilled to be a part of such a comparison between UOPS and RTN, because I think it would be interesting. And I think there are instances in which UOPS will be better, and I think there will be instances in which RTN will be better, and it would be great to map out exactly where to use which one. I think it would be a great guide to users in general. So, oh, I have this type of problem, so which one should I use, and what are the pros and cons, and have a more structured comparison. I think that would be great. But unfortunately, no, we haven't done that yet.
I think I might be able to convince Pedro Castro. I'll let you know.
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay. Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. Well, maybe on that note again, because since we have run over time, again, thank you so much for a very nice, very interesting and instructive seminar, Danielle. Okay? Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.